Good day and welcome to New Books in Music Podcast. I'm your host, Stephen Lee Naish. Today I'm joined by Tom Boniface Webb, co-author of the book I Was Britpopped, which was recently published by Valley Press. The book is a comprehensive A to Z guide of the bands, songs, people and places that defined the Britpop era. Welcome, Tom.
Hi, thank you for having me.
It's my pleasure. So before we get into the content of the book, I'd like to start with a little background information on yourself, so your educational background and your career up to this point.
Sure. So I'm originally from England, and I now live in New Zealand. Moved here about 3 years ago. My background is all in film, really. I mean, I've been writing from a young age, but I started writing in film and then working in film production. I worked at the British Film Institute in London for a long time. So that's what I've been doing here. So the writing stuff was all very much kind of in the background, really. Jenny, my co-author, and I, we met through being in a band about 10 years ago. That's how we met, through the sort of joint shared love of music. We both always had that love of music, and that's something we both continue to this day. So just before I left, about sort of nearly 3 years ago now, she came up with the idea of wanting to write this book about Britpop. It was something we were always talking about. It seemed like it was a kind of a relevant time, sort of the 20th anniversary of the kind of, you know, the core years and the key scene coming up. So she sort of came up with this idea of actually wanting to put it into the A to Z format. I sort of jumped on board. You know, I was always interested in writing anyway and always been such a huge fan of music and particularly of the Britpop era that it just seemed like a really good way, for us to sort of stay in touch and keep our relationship going when we're going to be 12,000 miles away, but also to, you know, bring a focus back on the scene that we had been such a pivotal part of our sort of musical education and, you know, general education and sort of coming of age stories when we were growing up. It just seemed like such a great idea. And then the more we got into it, the more it grew. And suddenly it became this sort of huge beast on this Google Documents that we were writing. We came up with sort of 500 plus entries about all of the key bands, all of the key, and then within that, subsections of all their key albums, all their key singles, and everything else that sort of went alongside it. So key music venues, magazines, newspapers, all that kind of stuff that, you know, we loved, clothing, all that kind of stuff that we loved. And it got to the point where we actually had to scale it down because we thought the book was just going to be too long. That was where the genesis of the idea came up to.
Yeah, well, I think it's definitely a prime time for a Britpop revival because, you know, over the last couple of years, the 90s has faced this kind of resurgence of interest, I think. And, there was a book on Oasis's Definitely Maybe. There was a documentary on Oasis. Yeah. And I think when the 20-year anniversary kind of kicked in, it was like, you know, people really wanted to look back at those times a little bit. So, yeah, there's definitely a time and a place for this book. So, you did mention anyway, I was going to ask about the co-author, Jenny Natasha, and how you guys met. So you guys met in a band.
Yeah, so I was playing in bands from about, you know, 16 years old. You know, Noel Gallagher taught me through the Wonderwall on the radio that you didn't have to be, you know, Brian May to be able to play the guitar, and you could just strum a few chords. And I picked up a guitar and played a few chords and formed a band, and I was playing for years after that. It was a real kind of obsession, writing songs. And then Jenny came on board in a band I was in called The Requiems when we were in London in about 2006, 2007. And we played together for a few years. She played keyboards and we played around London, and, you know, things were good. Things were going well. But I think priorities in life changed. I got much more focused on wanting to be writing. We stayed in touch and we were best friends, and we still are best friends. And we were always talking about music, always going to see bands, always going to see and always talking about how important Britpop was to us, and in particular Oasis. You were talking about Oasis, mentioned their sort of resurgence before, and I think they had such a huge impact on British music it's just undeniable how important they were. One of the biggest bands of all time, you know, and that's sort of part of it. But you know, then they were just the sort of the, you know, at the top of the whole crowd, you know. Blur and undeniably a very important band to the to British music as well. And it was that, it was the relationship together, you know. It was Britpop in itself was kind of, it feels like it was a kind of a reemergence of the 60s, swinging 60s Beatles and Stones, Carnaby Street scene itself. So it was interesting that it crossed over into the mainstream in the way that it did. And it's not surprising that we're looking back on it as sort of fond nostalgia in 20 years later now. It seems appropriate. I mean, that was sort of the original idea. And then it kind of coincided quite nicely. There was a really fantastic Blur documentary back in 2009 called No Distance After Run, when they got back together. And we went to see it in the cinema. We were just so excited again by that, by the music. We went to see them play in Hyde Park, and it was just every single word to every single song. And it was kind of like, wow, this is, you know, this is our childhood. And there are thousands and thousands of people in this field, all the same age as us, who are all part of this this crowd. And I don't know if that's going to be the same in 20 years time for the kids that are around today and the music that they have today. It doesn't feel like there's anything as big as Britpop was to us. As such, and then it sort of became a thing, you know. And you were talking about the Oasis documentary. I think you mean Supersonic, which came out last year, which was just, it was a fantastic movie, which specifically focused on the first 3 years of Oasis's life together. And you realize how much they actually achieved as a group, and you know, in such a short space of time. And that says as much about the time and the place and the people as it does about the band. And then, I mean, it'd be easy to say that all the other bands came in the sort of slipstream of Oasis and Blur, but it's not true. You know, there was a lot of drive for a musical scene, and I think it would have happened without those two. And that is happening again today. There's another one of the key reasons that we were in such a sort of so keen to get the book out in the way that it is because there's a lot of these bands are reforming for their kind of 20th anniversary of their key albums are being sort of re-released and repackaged. And this week, for example, the Verve's Urban Hymns has been, a couple of weeks ago, the Verve's Urban Hymns album has been put out as a 20th anniversary edition. And you sort of re-listen to that and you go, wow, what a fantastic album that was, you know? That's one of the sort of genre-defining albums as well. But you've got all these other bands. So you've got Shed Seven and the Blue Tones and Sleeper and Dodgy and all these bands that you thought you'd never see again are all getting back together, reforming and playing gigs and, you know, even releasing new materials and stuff like that. So it's kind of, it feels like a very exciting time if you're someone of a certain age, I guess. I mean, I'm hoping that the kids are listening to this stuff as well, because before Britpop, before I got into you know, before I got into Oasis, I got into Oasis through the Beatles. You know, my dad was playing the Beatles and the Rolling Stones and all those bands and stuff. So, you know, I hope the same thing is happening today, you know. I did see a kid the other day wearing a Kurt Cobain T-shirt.
You know what I think? Well, you mentioned there about like this kind of the music of that period. I mean, I was sort of in my late teens during the Britpop era, so it meant a lot to me. And I think in the UK right now, I think the only music really that's making a splash is grime music. But it's not as mainstream. It's definitely not as big. I mean, there's big artists in that scene, but it's not as big as Britpop for sure. But you know what? As well, Shed Seven did reform, and I follow them on Twitter, and apparently they're doing really well. They're doing better than they did first time.
Jenny went to see them the other day in London, and she met them afterwards and was talking to them about the book. And Alan, the drummer, has written something about the book, which is really fantastic. It was really sweet of him. So they're obviously supporters of us as well, which is great because we're huge fans of theirs. I remember skiving off school at 17 years old, don't tell my mum, please, and going and queuing up outside Virgin Records to get Shed Seven to sign a CD that I'd bought that day. You know what I mean? That's how kind of important the music was to us at the time. So yeah, it's really great to see these bands getting back together and doing the things that they're doing. And it's kind of interesting you were talking about what you said about the grime thing, because that's always been a tradition in British music of it being very reactionary to the times. People, the disadvantaged and disassociated youth wanting to scream at the, you know, inadequacies that given to them in the life. The same thing happened in the 70s with the punk movement. When the Sex Pistols started, they were just so angry at the world around them. And, you know, and I don't see any difference between the Sex Pistols or Public Enemy, for example, or NWA, who did the same thing years later. And exactly what you're saying now, the grind thing is it's a reactionary response to being dissatisfied.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I think Oasis were definitely a kind of working class reaction. But I was speaking to another author earlier this morning who wrote a book called 1997, The Future That Never Happened, which was published by Zed Books. And there's a chapter on Oasis in there. And the actual front cover of the book has Noel Gallagher shaking Tony Blair's hand, which is when they met that time in the 90s. And that kind of was the end of that era, I think. You know, that kind of ended any sense of rebellion that Britpop, at least Oasis anyway, could have. So
as soon as it crosses over into the mainstream, it automatically becomes part of, you know, everyday culture and everyday life. And we write about exactly what we were talking about. We write about Tony Blair in the book. And I think that's one of the things that really interested me about doing this book was giving it a cultural backdrop. No, so it's not necessarily just an encyclopedia about a bunch of bands and when they release songs. I wanted to give it a cultural relevance. I wanted to give it that kind of backdrop of why they were doing it and all the other things that came along. And obviously the two huge things that both happened in 97 and brought about the end of the Britpop era was Tony Blair coming to power and Princess Diana dying. And that was a huge thing. I mean, never underestimate the importance of how big Diana's death was to the British people. You know, it was just kind of the country went into this state of national mourning because of one woman had died, but because of the reasons as well, I think, which, you know, they're still disputed, but it was felt like it was because of the press and the mainstream media and stuff like that. But with Blair, it was an interesting one because he very much brought himself to power by getting the youth vote on side, and he did that by championing first Damon Albarn, who he brought into the Commons to speak, and then, yeah, later on by inviting them all to come to Number 10 Downing Street to drink tea and shake hands. And Damon Albarn actually turned down his invitation to that, but Noel didn't. He went along. Alan McGee went along, and they chatted about stuff. And Noel Gallagher famously stood on stage at the Brits and said that the only people doing anything for the youth in the country at that time were members of Oasis and Alan McGee and Tony Blair, you know, and that had been unprecedented. All they'd had beforehand was bands getting up and shouting about politicians and getting angry at politicians. And so there was this kind of feeling for a while that everything was okay, you know. But then the Labour government never sort of fulfilled, and, you know, they never fulfilled on the promises that they sort of had, or, you know, it was never fully realised. And music certainly went into a kind of a state of flux after Britpop finished. So, you know, our book finishes in April 98, which was when Pulp had released their album, This Is Hardcore, which we sort of considered to be the moment when it was this sort of big come down record, specifically told from Jarvis Cocker's point of view, when he was feeling this disassociation with life, taking too many drugs and drinking too much and all that kind of stuff. And so it was a come down record, but a raft of all these bands started to release records at that time. Oasis released it wasn't until 2000, but it took them a while longer. They released Standing on the Shoulder of Giants, which was originally titled Where Did It All Go Wrong? You know, there's a great song on that record called Where Did It All Go Wrong? And, you know, so it felt like everything was changing and everything was falling apart. And I don't know how you felt at the time, but being a teenager and the late teenager, at that time, I was 18 in 99, so just really wanting to get things going, and it just didn't feel like there was anything around I could get my teeth into, and it didn't until about 2001 when the Strokes came along. The Strokes kind of started everything again. It felt like they really kick-started everything off again. And then we've got this kind of second wave of Britpop, which is something Jenny and I are talking about at the moment, actually, which we're finding quite interesting, because through the years of sort of 2001 up to about 2005, I guess, there was this sort of second wave of Britpop. So you've got all these bands that like the Libertines and Razor Light, you know, and then later on the Arctic Monkeys and, you know, the Future Heads and all these really great you know, garage rock bands that sort of came in a sort of, I was made a list the other day and I got about 50 of them, which is pretty good going, seeing it's not far off from what we have in our Britpop book. So it kind of sees that there was this kind of second wave thing, but it was very much a homage to, you know, those few years before when Britpop took hold of Britain in a way that we hadn't seen since the 60s, you know.
So well, this book seemed like a really kind of fun project to research. So you know, how much time did you spend bringing this project together, flicking through old copies of the NME and listening to obscure B-sides? Did it take I mean, obviously, in some respects, you've been researching it since it happened. But, you know, when the idea came up, how long?
It came up, I think it was 2 years, all said and done. But that sort of took a while because as you say, this a book like this requires a lot of research. We wanted it to be accurate in the information, because we're kind of music geeks as well, so we wanted everyone to know what the third B-side on the second album from Sleeper's third album was, type thing, how many different formats each single was released on, you know, single, vinyl, and tape, and that kind of thing. We wanted all that information in there, and that took a long time to get the accurate information together. But most importantly, we wanted it to be our own experiences and our own memories that were put down on the page, because that's where we thought the passion would come from. And I think it did. And we wanted it to be a book for the fans. You know, we're fans of this era. And we wanted it to, the main reason that we always give for writing it is that it was the book that we would want to read, which hopefully I think is what most writers do. But we wanted it.
Yes, I think that's the most important.
Yeah, I hope so. And we wanted that sort of personal journey and personal experiences to come across. So, for example, you know, Jenny was lucky enough to go to Nebworth Park to see Oasis, which I think is kind of the era-defining show. It's, you know, the film.
Yeah, that's kind of our Woodstock, right?
Absolutely. Yeah, exactly. We're very lucky to have had that within our lifetime, and he was lucky enough to go. So she wrote in the entirety of the entry about Nebworth, and I think that shows in her writing is the kind of the way the passion came across, as a feeling, you know, she was a 15-year-old girl from South Wales, you know, that sort of got on a bus one day and went to Nebworth to watch her favourite band, and it was this kind of magical experience that happened, and that was what we wanted to come across in the writing, and I think we did. But, you know, we were getting on with our lives whilst we were doing it, and then the intention was always to put it out through self-publishing, because we knew there'd be an audience for it, and we wanted to get that kind of build of an audience once we put it out there. Spiral, obviously, using social media these days, we've got a really fantastic Instagram following and Twitter following, Facebook, and because we knew that we had a group of people that were there sort of ready looking for this book, well, we hoped we'd be able to do that. We thought we'd put it out ourselves, and so we did that, and that obviously took a lot longer as well. So the first edition came out at the end of last year, November time, a year ago. And then sort of pretty much straight away set about trying to find good publishers, and Valley Press were very interested immediately, and impressed with what we've done. And small independent publishers means you have a good, really strong working relationship with them. And then it took another time. But by that time, obviously, there'd been another load of things that had happened in the year since we put the first edition out. So we had to go back and put in a load of stuff. And some of the most fantastic stuff came out through that. Like, for example, you know, the huge tragedies that have happened this year in Britain, the Grenfell Tower and the attacks at the gig in Manchester. And people that came out in support of that. Like, for example, they had the thing in the central square in Manchester where they were having a minute's silence for the people that died in the terrorist attack. And suddenly one woman started singing Don't Look Back in Anger at the end of it. And everyone just started joining in. And before we know it, you know, suddenly Liam Gallagher, of all people, is singing an a cappella version of Don't Look Back in Anger at Glastonbury. And you know, Chris Martin and Coldplay are playing it at the benefit gig with Noel. And it's and Don't Look Back in Anger has suddenly become this huge modern day contemporary anthem that is against, you know, all the tragedies that are occurring in Britain. And so that gives this even more of a sort of a zeitgeisty feel, you know, everything happening again and happening for a reason. It shows how important First Oasis are to the general British consensus, but also to how Britpop is important to this as well. So yeah, that was the roundabout way of saying it. It took us a long time to write it, but we wanted to get it right, you know, and hopefully that our attention to detail has meant that it's as accurate as it can be. But it's a conversation, you know, it's a conversation. We want people to get in touch with us, and they have been, because, you know, people are fans and they want to share their own experiences and take it from there, because this is a book for the people. It was always the intention, always the plan. So we're very open to people contacting us on social media and telling us their thoughts and letting us know.
Yeah, well, that kind of brings me to a question, actually, because the book is a comprehensive A to Z of Britpop. And so that now people are engaging with it. Has anybody come up and said, oh, my God, you did not include this band?
Yeah, I mean, that was one of the good things about getting a chance to do the second edition, is that we could add in some updates or reasons why we hadn't included certain things. There was an ongoing thing about Radiohead, why they weren't included. And, you know, we made our reasons up pretty early on that we didn't want to include Radiohead, despite the fact that they had come along and found their sort of initial, well, you know, their first initial success was pre-Britpop with the whole Creep thing. But then the Bends came out, and that was very much in the middle of it all in 95. And then OK Computer came out and was huge in 97, but they were just so kind of almost transcended and purposely pushed away from being involved in it, and were big enough to exist in a silo without external influences, that it felt like it wasn't appropriate to sort of tag them on to this book in a way. Same thing was with Primal Scream. Who signed to Creation Records, who's sort of the key, Alan McGee's key label that Oasis was signed to. But it kind of felt, again, like they just had this huge chameleonic existence that meant that they almost sort of flitted between scenes and existed in this, you know, acid house scene before Britpop happened. And then they released a pure rock and roll Rolling Stones type record. And moved things on to this kind of electronica dirge after Britpop had happened and still existed in like that. So again, it felt like it kind of wasn't appropriate to put them on, as much as I would have liked to have written about those bands, you know, I'd like to have included them in. But yeah, I mean, there's always going to be things that you leave out, because it's the whole point of a scene is it's an arbitrary concept by generally by journalists and music industry folk, who are the very people that the people in the bands are rebelling against. And so sort of in creating a scene, it's you're sort of automatically distancing yourselves from the band. So it has to be a very elastic concept. It's a very easy sort of to chuck down Britpop. And so we had to lay our borders one place and finish them in another. And we go into our reasons why we did that, and I think it makes sense. But again, you're not going to be able to please all the people all the time, and that's sort of just, you know, we've accepted that. That's fine. one glaring omission from the first edition, and I hope people that have got it aren't too disappointed, but we left out the Stereophonics for some reason. I can't even remember why, but then suddenly had this thing, and I was a huge fan of Stereophonics when they first came out. And I remember buying their album, and it was, yeah, that first album was bang in the middle of it, the sort of, you know, final throes of it, but, you know, the scene and the years that we'd put down. And so I, you know, we came up with all these entries and wrote a bunch of things and put them in the second edition. And I think it was a great reason to buy the new edition.
Yeah. Well, that's a good point, actually. Yeah, the Stereophonics first record was a really big deal for me. I mean, I thought it was. I grew up in a very small town as well, and that album is about small town lives, you know. So it really did. I think you made the right decision about Radiohead. They felt too international at that time. They were almost they were just too big almost. One band that I felt like you missed out, and I'm not trying to pick at this, but I actually had to do my own research in this, was a band called Ultrasound, who were on the cover of The Enemy. They were on the cover of The Enemy, Melody Maker. They were in Select magazine all the time, and I thought, well, why did they not include it? So I did some research into it, and they never even achieved a top 20 hit. And so, you know,
I think they were a little bit later. Yeah, I went to their album. I bought their album when it came out, and I think that was about 99, I think, when their album actually came out. Shame, because they were a great band, but I think they were, again, ones that sort of fell into the cusp of being sort of slightly too late, perhaps. And, you know, a lot of the bands achieved success at the time because of association to this pop thing. And firstly, A&R men were signing bands because they thought, oh, it's a Britpop band, and just signing them, you know, willy-nilly after playing one gig to 2.5 men in, you know, the Dublin Castle in Camden. And then because there was an audience willing to go out and buy and spend money on records for these bands, that they knew they could get them into the charts easily enough. That wasn't the same, you know, post 98. And I think, yeah, Ultrasound were fantastic, but it's a shame they didn't get into the top 20. They had their album was great, and they had a track on this. They had a second CD on the track on the album, which was one song for half an hour. And I remember they used to play that live, and it was just mental. That kind of showed how music had changed and how everything changed. But then that happened in the same way before Britpop. Like I remember Steve Lamacq reading this interview with Steve Lamacq years ago, and he said that the week that Kurt Cobain died, like the day that Kurt Cobain died, was the same week that Oasis got their first front cover on The NME. So it was like a switch had gone off and everything had changed in one moment. And all of this grunge stuff that had sort of permeated into the mainstream, you know, across the Atlantic into Britain, was suddenly over, and Britpop had started properly, you know, and Oasis were now the band that everybody was going to be listening to. And that's just how time moves on, I guess.
Well, that definitely happened to me. I mean, I was a grunge kid from, you know, the age of like 12 to 14. And then I switched pretty much in 94, 95 and, you know, never looked back. Well,
this is going to sort of say very quickly, I think it's just a kind of, it's also a generational thing. It's also the kind of fact that time moves on. And I think it's quite a nice analogy to you. I don't have any older siblings, but friends of mine did. And so it was always the idea that perhaps your older brother was listening to Nirvana. And as much as you might like them, you wanted to find your own thing. And so if a new band comes along, you know, like Oasis, you go, that's mine. I'm going to grab onto that. And that provides that kind of sibling rivalry sort of thing. You know, it's the whole idea of generations changing and moving on as people get older, you know.
Yeah, I had an older sister who listened to, you know, Pearl Jam, Nirvana. And so I would sneak into her room, grab her cassette tapes and copy them and then sneak them back in. But anyway, let's move on to some of the actual content of the book, because one of the great things about this book is that it can be read page to page, or you can just dip in and out. But one of the entries that intrigued me was the first entry under the letter B, which was B-sides. So how important was the B-side in the era of Britpop?
Well, that entry, firstly, that entry was about three times as long, and I had to cut it right down. we had to edit it right down because It was just too long to put in the book, and the book would have just been too long. But it's a very interesting point. The whole idea of the B-sides began, you know, when they were making vinyl, you know, back in the, I guess it became a thing within rock music properly in the kind of 50s, when rock and roll came along. And, you know, you're releasing a single on your A-side, and so it made sense to put something else on the B-side. When the Beatles came around in the 60s, they had, you know, such a wealth of material, plus the fact that they had the two greatest songwriters of all time in their midst, that John and Paul were always competing. So they thought, well, let's just do double A-sides. So you had this idea of it being two kind of singles you released. I think the most famous version of that is Penny Lane and Strawberry Fields Forever, probably, which is also one of the most famous number two singles of all time. So when it kind of like moved on and people started creating CDs in the kind of 70s and 80s, and then bands started popularly releasing CDs as sort of the format, they added in more B-sides because they had more material. And so sometimes you had sort of four, and then even more than that, you have five songs that you could release. This then obviously came to prominence with Noel Gallagher's songwriting, because he, you know, he said himself in Contemporary Times that he almost feels like he was too arrogant at the time to put all of those fantastic songs on those early singles. So, like, for example, when Some Might Say came out, and that was the first Oasis number one, and we chart that as the first Britpop number one single, the B-sides were just as strong as the A-sides were. It was, the idea being, it was supposed to be another way for bands to release material. He also used it, you know, Acquiesce, for example, is the third B-side to the Some Might Say single, and that's just a stronger song in a lot of ways. You know, Talk Tonight is this kind of really moody, introspective ballad that he's put on there as track two. And so they almost came like mini albums, if you like. You know, there was no competing song in the charts. And this kind of just grew from there. Bands sort of jumped on that bandwagon and started releasing more and more material. They would do acoustic versions of famous songs or live versions of famous songs to sort of bolster out the material. And so by the late 90s, like Embrace, for example, sort of Britpop but post-Britpop band, were, you know, releasing five or six songs on just a single, a CD single that you could buy in the shops. And as is always the way with these sorts of things, it became a backlash against it from the major record labels who had these sort of pop acts, couldn't compete with this wealth of material. Their acts could only really, you know, they normally only had one or two singles, you know, covering the whole experience. So the decision was made by the powers that be, and I wish I could sort of know exactly who those powers were, that a single could now only be released with three tracks on it. And I think that happened in about 98 99. I remember it happening and being really disappointed, because, you know, every time your favorite band released a new song, it was great, so there's going to be loads more, you know, B-sides to listen to. But that's sort of, you know, that's the way it goes, I guess. And that's still the way now. I think music has changed so much in the modern day, to the point where a lot of big bands don't release singles anymore. Or if they do, it's, you know, one of the key songs on the album, just chucked on iTunes or Spotify a few weeks before the album comes out. Or, you know, the one that they play on the radio or on Jules Holland or whatever. But what I think that's kind of changed, and that's fine. I'm fine with music evolving. And what it seems to be the way that I was thinking about this the other day, and the way that bands seem to do things these days, is that you get bonus materials. So you get deluxe editions of albums. So, you know, Noel Gallagher releases his solo album, and it's got the classic 11 tracks on it, and you can buy it for $9.99 on iTunes. And then a few weeks later, there'll be the deluxe edition that comes out for the real fans, and then that will have five or six extra bonus tracks on it, so, you know, you bolstered up to about 16-17 tracks in total. And I guess that's the modern day equivalent of B-sides, and it's a way of bands releasing extra materials. And you can understand why. Like, I'm a huge fan of the album, and the album being a piece of artwork, something that really only sort of came in with the Beatles, really, in the 60s, and then became this huge thing in the 70s, where bands like Led Zeppelin weren't, and Pink Floyd wouldn't even release singles. You know, they weren't interested in that way of releasing music. They were interested in releasing an idea of an album as a piece of artwork. And what I find really fascinating these days is when you buy an album, or listen to an album, some of the more traditional acts. I'm a huge fan of Ryan Adams, who the alt country artist, and I still buy his stuff on vinyl. And his albums are put together to be listened to on vinyl. You get it. You know, you can understand it, because by the time you flip over onto the second side, there's another really strong song to start side two. So you know he's put this collection of songs together to be listened to in a specific way. But sort of coming back full circle, the idea of the B-side, it started out as just, you know, the flip side to the A-side. And then it became this idea of just another way for bands to release albums. And then bands released a compilation of their B-sides as a whole album released. Ocean Colour Scene did a fantastic one. And then Oasis did, obviously, The Master Plan a few years later. And that's an interesting way, you know. It's the way that sort of music evolves that is kind of so fascinating. But the reason that we included that on there is partly because it's almost like a historical content these days. You know, it seems so logical to us, but now, you know, if you talk to my younger sister, who's 17, she'd have no idea, you know, about going out to shops and buying CD singles and stuff. It doesn't make any sense. You know, you can get everything online.
Yeah, definitely. So another entry in the B section of the book was the Battle of Britpop. So could you just tell us a little bit about this and what happened during that time and how big of a splash it made?
Oh, the day the world changed. It had been Oasis and Barrett leading up to that time had both been huge bands that had released huge records. Blur released Park Life in 1994, which was their third record, and it was a huge hit. And they won a bunch of Brit Awards at the 94 Brit Awards, 95. And then that same year, Oasis released Definitely Maybe, which also became a huge, huge record. But they missed out on the Brit Awards in February 95. And Blur actually said on stage about the best album, Brit Award, this award should have been shared with Oasis. And came to regret it a long time later, because it kind of started this rivalry between the two bands, which just spiraled from there. Then shortly after that, Oasis released Some Might Say, which was the first song to be released from their second album. And because of the crest of the wave that they were riding, it went straight in at number one. And Blur hadn't had a number one up to that point. And neither had any of the other bands that were kind of their contemporaries, or even the bands that had influenced then. So I'm talking about, you know, the Stone Roses and Happy Mondays and those kind of Manchester bands. And so Oasis were sort of riding this crest, this huge thing, and it just felt like the next thing to happen would be the biggest thing they could possibly do. But Blur, at the same time, were also coming off the back of a huge, huge album, arguably the bigger band at the time. And so this kind of thing happened, and the Gallagher brothers being, you know, as confrontational as they were and wanting to be difficult and antagonistic in the press. But then Damon Albarn and Blur never shying away from that kind of thing either. And it started to be this rivalry. Oasis set the date for Roll With It to be released, which would have been the second single from their second album, in August. And Blur did the same thing. They were due to release the first single from what would be their fourth album, The Great Escape, a song called Country House. And the story goes, and Damon Albarn has confirmed this to date, he moved the release date so that it coincided with the release of Oasis's single. And then the media picked it up, and it just spiraled from there. I mean, you must remember what was happening at the time. This is when it became the thing in schoolyards when people were, who are you, Blur, Oasis? And it became this huge thing. And you kind of either bought, you were one side or the other. And I remember going to music stores, and I was very much in the Oasis camp. And a friend of mine bought both. And he sort of thought, well, what's the point there? You might as well buy neither. This is a rivalry. You know, this is a competition. This is a battle. That's when things crossed over into the mainstream. And by Sunday the 14th of August, everyone was watching and everyone was listening to the radio to see who was going to come out on top. And it was on the news, you know, it was on the main news in the evening. And it's talking about this rivalry of these two bands, you know, these two bands that were just part of this world that we were coming into. You know, this had never happened before. This had never been, you know, the Beatles and the Stones were good friends. They'd never competed, you know, but competing in the charts. Those bands back in the 60s competed in the charts with other acts. So like I mentioned before, Strawberry Fields failing to get to number one, it was Engelbert Humperdinck that got to number one. That wasn't something the Beatles were trying to do. This now, back to the 90s, was a battle between these two bands that we loved, and the press just leapt on it, and we loved it. It just became this fantastic rivalry. And Blur got to number one and sold some ridiculous amount of singles. They released the single on two versions as well. They released CD1 and CD2, which obviously did mean that fans could buy both and it would count as two copies. I mean, you could buy 1,000 copies if you wanted, but you know, you could still call yourself a fan. I wanted to buy both. That's just how it worked. Whereas Roll With It only came out on the one. So they had a sort of slight advantage there. I'm not saying they did that on purpose, because they always did that. But, you know, they did have that sort of slight advantage. And so that was this huge thing. And it was, and then on the Top of the Pops, because all the bands played Top of the Pops the following Thursday, the Gallagher brothers played, but they, it was a kind of protest. They swapped instruments. So Noel came onto the microphone and was pretending to sing the vocals. And Liam was, who couldn't even play guitar at the time, was miming guitar, you know, as his kind of thing. And they loved the rivalry, and they loved to mock each other. But then it sort of carried on from there, and it became this even bigger thing after that, because then both of the bands released their albums, and Great Escape was good, but it kind of did sort of normal business. What's the Story, Morning Glory, Oasis album, just went on to become this huge, huge, ridiculous phenomenon. It's one of, I think it's like the third biggest selling British album of all time. You know, it just became this ridiculous thing. And that was sort of partly because of Oasis' next single, Wonderwall, and then the following single, Don't Look Back in Anger, which just became these huge things. And they went on to sweep the board at the Brit Awards the next year, with the winning the same amount. They won four awards. And so it was interesting to see how those things developed. You could have said that Blur won the battle, but Oasis won the war. But then how did that turn out in the long run? They're all friends now, which is nice.
I think the thing about the Battle of Britpop for me was that it was huge, but neither song was particularly brilliant. Like Oasis's Roll With It had just an awful, awful video. And the Country House video was directed by Damien Hirst, who's a British artist. And that was just really like campy and over the top. But neither song was really that strong, especially from those records. So let's move on, because I want to talk to you about the indexing that you used in the sort of tier system. So you have three tiers within the book, and tier one is the big five. So that's Oasis and Blur, Suede, Pulp, and Elastica. So I think it's really easy to talk about those bands because they were so huge. They had such a massive impact. But what bands from the tier two and the tier three would you have liked to have pulled out and seen just do better things and pull them into the tier one?
Oh, it's a good point, actually. It's interesting to talk about, because obviously you kind of have your own personal favorites of music, of albums and bands, and then you have the stuff that you know is more important to the subject you're writing about. I've got two examples, I guess, from the second, for the, well, what we call the top tier, the Britpop bands. And Manson and the Manic Street Preachers were two of the bands that were really important to me when they came about. And I think Manson's Attack of the Grey Lantern was such an important record to me. When I first heard it, it came out in 97, just blew my socks off. And it was just, wow, someone can create this music and the way it's sort of presented. And it was big, it was number one. But then I always felt like somehow Manson kind of missed out on being bigger than they were. Like, not many of my friends seemed to like them as much as I did. And I went to see them play live, and it never sort of seemed to be as electric as it was on that record. And you know, I don't know why that kind of happened, because it was something that was so kind of important to me. Other bands sort of didn't talk about them in the best way in the press and stuff. I remember being really disappointed by that. But you know, funny, that's something that Jenny and I both agree on, is how much we love Manson and how much we love that first album. But that's, I guess that's just the way it sort of goes with these things. You can't predict what's going to be big and what's not going to be big. Manic Street Preachers, I mean, they very much did succeed to be this huge band that we all know and love. And I became sort of obsessed with them, actually, but sort of slightly later, around sort of 2000, I became about really obsessed with them. And you know, listen to them and read all the stuff, and you know, this fantastic story that they have all about the Richie Edwards going missing, which is a horribly sad story. He was incredibly depressed guy that went missing, and it's presumed that he killed himself, but his body was never found, so they never knew what actually happened to him, and that's still the truth to this day. And so I wrote a lot about the band. I wrote all about the first album and the second album and all about the singles. But then we made this decision through space issues, we didn't want the book to be too long and too dense, that we were only going to include the top 20 singles for those bands, top 20 singles and albums for the second tier bands throughout the whole period. And that purely came down to a space thing, but also because it shows the importance that certain bands had to the scene. You know, a lot of the bottom tier ones, I can't even remember who's in that. I mean, I think Garbage, I think, are in the bottom tier. It's about bands that were just around at the time and sort of tagged onto the scene, and we think would have found success anyway, would have done their own thing anyway, but found more success and prominence because of their association with the scene. So it kind of made sense just to include their entries within the sort of peak years, where it just felt like anybody could release anything and it would hit the top 20. And you know, there was a lot of brilliant stuff out there, but there was also these sort of crazy stories about how this kind of came about. You know, there's a story that Menswear formed just because of the singer turned up at Glastonbury and blagged his way into Glastonbury by saying he was in a band called Menswear, and then spent the rest of the day telling everybody about this band, and there was no band. And he returned home with a record deal for a band that didn't yet exist to then have to put them together. I don't know if that's true. I hope it is.
I hope so too. And in fact, actually, there was an entry in your book under the band for the band Geneva, who I know the name. I can't think of a song that they did, but you make a point in there about them being signed only after maybe a few demos and a couple of rehearsals. That just seemed to happen. And Menswear are a perfect example. I didn't hear that story, but I heard they only had about six songs when they went in to record their record. And then the rest, they had to kind of string it together. So I think that's definitely right. With the where you mentioned Manson, and now that you've mentioned them, I would have liked to have seen Manson in the tier one as well, actually, because I really, really enjoyed their second record, actually. I thought that was an incredible record. I think the Manic Street Preachers, I think they transcended Britpop anyway. And I think they even beyond tier one, my own personal choices of that would have been Ash and the Blue Tones. I would I would have loved to have seen them become bigger bands. I mean, Ash's second record was not Britpop at all. It was almost like US garage rock, but I really loved that record. The Bluetones' second record as well was a bit darker.
I think Ash are a nice example, but then they did their own thing anyway. I think they just started out being lumped in with the Britpop bands, and they were on the harder edge of it anyway. The guitars were always that bit louder. They were always more interested in louder bands. But they did really well after Britpop existed anyway. Their third album went to number one, you know, and that was, I think it's called Free All Angels, in about 2002 or something. It was a kind of mixed blessing for them being lumped in with Britpop, because a lot of the bands lost any kind of record deals or whatever by being associated so specifically with the Britpop band. And I worry that the Bluetones are one of those ones that was too associated with the scene. And it meant they had incredible initial success, but then went on for that to kind of dwindle. And it's difficult. You don't know how these things can happen, because I agree. I thought their second and their third album, I thought, was really great too. But you can't predict these things. You have your own. And that's why it must be so difficult to be someone that chooses who to sign and what records to put out, because it's so subjective, you know? But there were times within that kind of, yeah, I think Geneva were a good example, because I think they were a good band, but they didn't have to strive enough for it to mean that much to them when they kind of made it, you know. Whereas these other bands, you hear about this kind of hunger and drive that they had to just play music to people, so that when it finally happens, it's this incredible thing, you know, and it means a lot, and they work so hard to maintain it. You know, they're a really good example of that, because they sort of nearly lost their record deal. First album was a big album, but the second album did fail to hit the mark, and that was such a shame, because it really felt like Modern Life is Rubbish was starting something. You know, we count that as the first Britpop album, you know, and it felt like they were changing something. But then I guess maybe the audience wasn't ready, and because then the whole Parklife thing happened, you sort of fine to see that in retrospect. But with someone like Manson, it was a shame to see them not be able to cling to their success, I guess.
Yeah. Well, again, you know, with Paul Draper, who was the singer of Manson, he's released a solo record quite recently. And again, he's doing incredibly well. And he's going to go out on tour, and he's going to play Attack of the Grey Lantern all the way through.
And Six as well. He said he'll do Six as well a bit later on, which is great. I mean, I don't know how he's going to do Six live, because that record was crazy. You know, it had, you know, middle eights within middle eights, and it was just all over the place. But I loved it. But it was.
Let's just touch quickly on the artwork, because when I saw this book, the artwork gripped me straight away. I mean, it's such a brilliant illustration that's on the book there. Who did that? And, you know, when did that come from?
That was great. I mean, we just fell in our lap, basically. We knew that we weren't going to have the money to be able to use photographs. And that's because you have to pay for the rights and stuff like that. So we wanted to think of a way around it. That's, you know, firstly, that's why we chose to do a lot of those infographics and those band origin maps and the number one albums maps, which were done by a great guy called Aaron in London, who's a colleague of Jenny's. But because we wanted to make strength of what we could use at our disposal, you know. But then the artwork on the cover was done by a guy called JP Cushion, who's Korean, I think. I hope I haven't got that wrong. Who was this fantastic artist that just Jenny got in touch with. And we talked about what kind of thing we wanted. And we wanted it to be, you know, we toyed with lots of different ideas, actually. We had the idea of using, you know, just a brick, you know, the Union Jack logo, or like a burning Union Jack, or Noel's Union Jack guitar, that kind of stuff. But then sort of settled on the idea of it being the five faces. And he just came up with this really great illustration of those guys that we would just loved using it. We were just more than happy to use it. And now what's really nice is that it feels like that has become one of the key. It's really nice that you raised that point, because it feels like now that's been one of the key things about the book that's kind of synonymous with it. You know, people look at that illustration, they'll think of the book, you know, and think of us and what we've done. So it's it's nice that that kind of thing has come full circle. And, you know, Valley Press got involved, and the cover that Valley Press have put together is really great as well. It's really nicely. It's much nicer than the one that we put together initially, which is great as well, because I think it gives it its own nice individuality. Well, that was kind of the idea anyway.
Oh yeah, though, it's fantastic. So we're going to be coming to the end anyway of this interview. But I wanted to ask, why do you think that Britpop music is just not made anymore in the UK? Why do you think it's fizzled out?
I don't think it has fizzled out. I think it's still there, and there are bands that I'm listening to now who I think owe very much a debt to the Britpop thing. You know, I think the Arctic Monkeys, for example, are still sort of doing that. There's bands like Catfish and the Bottlemen, you know, even someone as far as Everything Everything or Two Door Cinema Club, you know, who I think are great bands, are sort of influenced by that music, by the scene. But music moves on, you know, it kind of has to adapt to survive. And the whole idea of Spotify these days means there's such a wealth of stuff out there, people making stuff. It's kind of not done in the same way. Bands can't make the same money as they used to from album sales and from record sales, and it's mostly done from live gigs. But meaning, which sort of is one thing, that's over on the left hand here, but on the right hand, how easy it is to record stuff these days, and people could just do it at home on their laptop, and then you can get it on Spotify yourself. It sounds as good as it would have done in the studio years ago. There's so much stuff on there. There's such a wealth of stuff. It's very difficult for people to pull things together into scenes the way that they used to. Plus, you know, the NME doesn't arrive on my doorstep any longer, and so I don't know. I'm not told who to like any longer. I'm joking, of course. But, you know, journalism doesn't seem to sort of work the same way as it used to. But I was listening to this great band called Wolf Alice, who is, you know, female fronted band who lay a huge debt to Elastica, you know, and so I think it is there. I think it's happening. It's just, it's not as obvious as it was back in the Britpop time. And that's because music works in a different way. The digital age has diversified everything so much that there are so many pockets these days. It's very, if you tap into your little pocket and you can find it and you can link it and then you've got it and it's theirs and it's yours and you can follow bands around still in the same way. But it's not as obvious to everybody else, I guess. It's harder to go out and find stuff. But it is there, you know, and that's exciting. And people do lay a debt. You know, the Arctic Monkeys say that the first record that they bought was Be Here Now, you know, and the Oasis album. And that's great to hear, you know. And I think they owe a debt as well. But all of the Britpop stuff was itself retrospective in a lot of ways. You know, they wore their influences on their sleeve. So I guess it just follows in a long tradition of what's happening and what's moving on. I mean, I can't wait to see the next Oasis come along and be this huge, awe-inspiring band, the way that we had it when we were younger. You know, that really excite me. But, you know, these things go in cycles. We'll see what happens. Watch around the corner.
Yeah, well, you know, as short as it was, I'm glad that, you know, it wasn't all for nothing and that bands are still tapping into that that Britpop, because, you know, it did mean a lot. So what's next for you? Are you writing any other books, or are you working on any other projects?
Yeah, I mean, the plan, if it works out, is to do a series of these books. Which would be cool. And the logical thing for us to do would be focus on each of the five bands, getting their own individual book. So we'd probably start with Oasis and do an A to Z of Oasis that follows their whole career rather than just the Britpop thing. We'd recycle a lot of the stuff we've already got and put it into there. It'd be much thinner than this one, but would still be a sort of, you know, a must for any sort of fan of the band, and then sort of following a series of that to see how it works. But as I was saying before, there's also the idea of doing something about the second wave of Britpop, so that kind of early 2000s Libertines, you know, sort of scene, which I was very much part of because I was sort of that bit older, so, and living in London, so it was easier to go and see the band. which felt like it was more of an international thing. So I don't know, you know, you've got bands like The Killers and Interpol and all these sorts of people. So I don't know quite how that's going to work at the moment, but we'll see. Watch this space, please.
Yeah, well, we certainly will be. So they sound, whatever you're up to, that sounds fantastic. I really want to thank you, Tom, for coming on the podcast. It's been a really great talk.
Thank you very much.
And your book is really good, and I wish you lots of success with that.
That's fab. Thank you so much.